All right, welcome back everyone to the deep dive. We're gonna be today digging into something pretty interesting, and it's sometimes kind of tricky to navigate in the legal world, especially when you're dealing with a ton of different cases. We're looking at two separate cases from the 11th Circuit, and here's the kicker. They're both called United States v. Willis.
That's got to be confusing.
So yeah, for all you law students out there, and anyone really who's trying to make sense of case law, this is like exhibit A on why details, really matter.
Absolutely. You can't just skim the title and think you've got the whole picture.
Right. So we've got these two Willis cases, and they're totally different. One deals with a conviction for aggravated sexual abuse. So we're going to be diving into some pretty complex evidentiary issues there.
Right. Evidence is key in those kinds of cases.
And then the other Willis case is all about drug trafficking. We'll be looking at the collective knowledge doctrine, how that plays into probable cause, and some really important stuff about procedural rights during jury selection.
It's amazing how one name can cover so much legal ground.
It really is. So let's jump right in. First up, United States v. Willis, the case involving the aggravated sexual abuse of a minor identified in the case as KM. Now, the facts are super important here, as always. So Willis, he admitted to having sex with KM, but his defense was that it was consensual.
Okay, so right away there's a dispute about consent.
Exactly. And KM, she alleged that he used force. So during the investigation, they found semen on KM's underwear, and it was from both Willis and KM's boyfriend.
That's interesting. So what happened with that evidence?
Well, the defense, they wanted to use the fact that the boyfriend's semen was there to argue that KM had a motive to lie.
To lie about the encounter with Willis.
Yeah, the thinking was that maybe she was trying to hide the fact that she had sex with Willis from her boyfriend.
Okay, I see.
And since she was babysitting for her cousin at the time, maybe she was also worried about her cousin finding out.
Trying to cover her tracks on a couple of fronts.
Right. But the district court, they said, nope, we're not letting that evidence in.
Interesting. So why did they exclude it? Was this where Federal Rule of Evidence 412, the Rape Shield Law, came into play?
That's exactly right. For those of you who are, knee-deep in evidence law right now, FRE 412, it basically limits what kind of evidence you can bring up about a victim's sexual history. And in this case, the court said, even if the defense thinks it shows motive, it's not directly relevant to whether Willis used force or not.
So the court's saying the boyfriend's semen doesn't directly prove or disprove the use of force.
Yeah, and they also said even if it was a little bit relevant, it could really prejudice the jury, make them focus on the victim's past instead of what Willis did.
Right. That's the whole point of the Rape Shield Law, to prevent victim blaming and focus on the actions of the accused. Did the 11th Circuit agree with the district court on this?
They did. They upheld the exclusion of the evidence. And they also agreed that there was enough other evidence to support the guilty verdict. KM's testimony and the fact that her cousin basically said she wouldn't approve of KM having sex with Willis, that was enough for them.
Okay, so the conviction stands. But I understand there was also some discussion of rehafe error during the appeal. What exactly is that for those of us who might not be familiar with the term?
Yeah, so a rehafe error, it's something that comes up in cases where someone is convicted of possessing a gun when they're not legally allowed to have one. Basically, the Supreme Court said in Rehafe v. United States, the government can't just prove you had a gun. They have to prove that you knew you weren't allowed to have it. So a rehafe error happens when the jury instructions don't make that clear.
So it's about the defendant's knowledge of their prohibited status.
Right. Now, in this specific Willis case, the 11th Circuit didn't find a rehafe error. It probably had something to do with, I'm guessing, another charge related to a firearm, but we don't
Yeah.
have all the details on that.
Got it. It sounds like Willis might have had more legal trouble than just the sexual abuse charge.
It seems that way, yeah. Now, here's a twist. Even though the 11th Circuit said the conviction was okay, they sent the case back to the district court to redo the sentencing.
Why was that?
It all came down to drugs. During sentencing, the district court took into account some drugs that were found in an upper apartment, but the 11th Circuit said there wasn't enough evidence to tie those drugs specifically to Willis.
Interesting. So even though the sexual abuse conviction stood, there were still problems with the sentencing because of the drug issue.
Exactly. And this is super important for all of you future lawyers. You got to have solid evidence for everything, even during sentencing, even if it seems like it's not directly related to the main crime.
Makes sense. You can't just assume guilt by association.
Right. So that's case number one. Let's move on to the second United States v. Willis, which is all about drug trafficking. This one involves Willis and a co-defendant named Mahdi.
All right, so a totally different set of facts here.
Absolutely. This time we've got a plane landing late at night at Montgomery Airport, specifically at Denali Field, and right away there are some red flags. This plane, a twin-engine Piper Navajo, it parked in a weird spot, like a dimly lit area, and they even ignored the standard parking signals.
Sounds suspicious already. What happened next?
Well, some airport linemen saw all these large green duffel bags inside the plane's cabin, and it was just enough to make them think, something's not right here. So they reported it to airport security.
Smart move. They're not going to just ignore something that looks that out of place.
No way. And then a narcotics officer, Officer Anderson, he gets involved, starts looking into it, and he starts to suspect that those duffel bags are full of cocaine.
So things are getting serious now. Mm-hmm. What happened with Willis and Mahdi?
So while all this is going down, Willis and Mahdi, they try to take off. Mahdi starts walking away from the airport. The linemen spot him and identify him. Willis gets in a taxi, an officer sees him, and then the police pull the taxi over.
Trying to make a quick getaway. But what about those duffel bags? Was Officer Anderson right about the cocaine?
Oh, he was right. They searched the plane and found over 800 pounds of cocaine.
Wow, that's a lot of cocaine. Where was it coming from?
They figured it came from Colombia. Plus, there was this document, something they call the standard brief, which they use in aviation investigations, and it showed that the plane had false ownership information.
Okay, so you've got suspicious behavior, a ton of cocaine, and fake ownership records.
Yep, pretty clear picture of illegal activity. So the big question becomes, was there probable cause to arrest Willis and Mahdi? The court said yes, and they used the collective knowledge doctrine to reach that decision.
Ah, the collective knowledge doctrine. Could you explain that one for our listeners?
Sure. So it basically means that to figure out if there was probable cause, you can combine all the information that all the officers involved in the case knew. It doesn't matter if any one officer had enough on their own, as long as they were all working together, communicating with each other.
So it's a team effort.
Exactly. So in this case, they looked at what the lineman saw, what security saw, and what Officer Anderson found out, and together, it was enough to say, yeah, there's probable cause.
It makes sense. Like with the cocaine, the lineman didn't know that's what it was, but Officer Anderson suspected it.
Right. And then you add in the suspicious parking, the drawn curtains on the plane, the fact that it probably came from Colombia, and the fake ownership info. All those pieces together, it paints a pretty clear picture.
So that leads to the arrest. What happened after that?
Well, there's another interesting part about this case. It involves jury selection, specifically the voir dire process. Willis and Mahdi, they were there for the general questioning of potential jurors, but not for the individual questioning that happens later in the judge's chambers.
Ah, so they missed part of the process. Did the court say anything about that?
They did. The court ruled that Willis and Mahdi had basically given up their right to be there for that part of voir dire because they didn't object to being absent.
So even though they were present for part of it, they didn't speak up about missing the individual questioning, and the court considered that a waiver.
Exactly. In the 11th Circuit, they really emphasized that you have to actively protect your rights in court. If you know you have a right and you don't use it or object when something's not right, you might lose that right.
It's a good lesson for everyone.
Yeah.
You can't just sit back and expect your rights to be automatically protected. You have to be involved and speak up.
Absolutely. Okay, one more legal issue came up in this case. It had to do with some things Mahdi said when they arrested him. He was trying to say he was innocent, but the court wouldn't let those statements in as evidence.
Why not? That sounds like it would be important for his defense.
Well, those statements were considered hearsay. Hearsay is basically something someone said outside of court that you're trying to use in court to prove what they said is true. And usually, hearsay isn't allowed as evidence.
There are a few exceptions, though, right?
Right, but this wasn't one of them. The court said it violated the confrontation clause of the Sixth Amendment.
The right to confront your accusers.
Right, because if Mahdi wasn't going to testify himself, then the prosecution couldn't cross-examine him about those statements, you know, to test if they were really true.
So the court said those statements couldn't be used unless he testified and was subject to cross-examination.
Exactly.
So in the end, the court upheld the convictions of both Willis and Mahdi in this second Willis case. It sounds like their actions, like trying to run away and the false information about the plane's ownership, really hurt their case.
Yeah, I'd say so. They didn't really help themselves.
And this second Willis case gives us some really good stuff to think about, you know, especially for those in law school. First, it's a great example of how the collective knowledge doctrine works in real life, like how different officers can put their information together to establish probable cause.
It's a good illustration of how teamwork can play out in a legal sense.
Exactly. And then the whole thing with the voir dire waiver. It's a reminder that you've got to participate in every part of the legal process and make sure your rights are protected. Don't just assume things will work out in your favor if you stay silent.
Speaking up is key.
Right. And finally, the hearsay issue. It reinforces why hearsay is generally excluded and how important that is for fairness in trials.
You have the right to confront the people who are accusing you.
Exactly. So to wrap up our deep dive today, we've looked at two 11th Circuit cases, both called United States v. Willis. One focused on sexual assault and evidence issues, and the other on drug trafficking and those specific procedural points.
It's wild how two cases with the same name can be so different.
Absolutely. And as you all continue your legal studies, think about how these different legal principles, things like evidence rules, probable cause, procedural rights, how they all connect and affect different kinds of cases.
It's all connected.
Right. Like, how would the collective knowledge doctrine work if you had a fast-moving emergency versus a planned investigation? Or think about the big picture. What does it mean for society when we're trying to protect victims with FRE 412 while also making sure defendants can defend themselves fairly?
It's a complex system.
It really is. And we'll keep bringing you more deep dives into important legal cases and what they mean for all of you learning the law. So stay tuned for those.
Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.